Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports. I am Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And I guess that's who we were last week, too, which really isn't surprising. We have a lot from the world of sports to talk about. Again, we have no guests, so you're you're stuck with us for the next half an hour, or hour, really, as it were. Because the show has been an hour the whole time it's existed.
Always has. Never been a half hour.
No, I know. Oh, it's just been one of those weeks. It's one of those weeks that I wish I was getting paid to be at a baseball field.
By the hour?
By the hour. It's been a lot of weeks, or a lot of hours. I can't even talk. A lot of hours this week, a lot of pitches thrown on the pursuit of a Little League World Series crown. And one thing that I never quite realized, even though I've peripherally been around this and you have too over the years, is the sheer amount of time that it takes for people and the amount of checkpoints that you have to pass through. Ultimately, somebody gets to Williamsport, but there are a lot of checkpoints to get there. Did you guys win state when you played back in Maine?
We came in second.
Second in state to whom?
Augusta.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Was there anybody notable on that Augusta team?
I don't remember how far any of them went.
Okay.
But I know at the time there was a great collection of talent, and throughout high school, all their guys were, you know, first team, second team, all state. So, and I don't know how big the area was that Augusta was drawing from, but
right.
I think it was rather sizable. You know, they had a good region to draw from.
Yeah, well, and some things have changed along the way too, where back then there was no such thing as Cal Ripken. Little League was the only real show in town, and even talking to Kevin Levine a few weeks ago, the number of teams that were in the playoff ultimately to get into the district championship and then to get into the state championship, there were more teams back then. A lot of towns, for whatever reason, have chosen to adopt Cal Ripken, which is a different program entirely, but doesn't feed into the Little League World Series.
Yeah, my nephew, Tuck, who plays in Maine, in Bath, which is one of the bigger towns, I don't even know if it's considered a city, but it's a sizable area for Maine. He plays in Cal Ripken, and that's what they have. He's actually out in Kansas right now with the family. They're going to be going to a Royals game here soon. So they're representing for us in Kauffman Stadium.
Bath is listed, for anybody who's wondering, Bath is listed as a city.
Okay, there you go.
I don't know what the qualifications of it are. The population's about 8,400.
Whoa, I would have guessed it was more than that.
So at least that's what this says. Wikipedia is my source here. But it's Cal Ripken has taken over. Of course, the Cal Ripken programs no longer feed in, but that doesn't make any of this any less challenging to get there. And some people look at it and say, fewer Little League teams means fewer kids are playing baseball. Well, we talked to Joe Riccio a few months back about the overall health of baseball in this town, and we've seen it go up the last few years in terms of the number of kids who are playing. About 500 kids played all age groups this year. I think ultimately they could probably get more by expanding at the younger ages to include more girls, because more girls, believe it or not, are starting to play baseball. Of course, I have one who does. There's one in Goffstown as well who's playing on their 10 district team. So there are a number of opportunities to continue to grow the game. And then the other thing that you see that also goes along with it is the sizable number of kids who love the game and take the opportunity to play travel ball earlier, which I never played. Did you? You never did either, right?
For travel baseball?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I did AAU.
But that's like high school, right?
High school, yeah.
Okay, so at that point, and there's a slight age difference between us, at the point when I graduated high school, which was 1991, nobody was doing that. And you play multiple sports. There were the occasional scout games or area code games out in California where you would be seen. But other than that, you were playing high school and fall ball and summer ball. And if you wanted to play all year, you could, and you could continue to improve. There, the weather is far more conducive to it. But out here, we have some indoor facilities. I said it to Maggie a few weeks ago. In 4 years of high school, we practiced indoors once.
In 4 years of high school in Maine, we practiced outdoors before the season started probably once.
Well, it's cold up there.
You would go and do your, sometimes you would go for your run outside, you know, 2 mile run to get in shape. Maybe you would do some long toss in the parking lot, certainly not on grass.
Right.
I mean, who would dream of that?
Right.
Nobody in Maine.
Grass is covered in snow. Grass is stuff that is fake until snow melts.
Until you're scrimmaging in April and it's still snowing while you're on the grass.
Yeah, you're like, wait a second. Well, we had that happen at one of the Bedford High games down in Mass.
That's right.
Where all of a sudden we're standing out there and, wait a second, there's a little bit of snow coming down. Nice cold day, but good one to watch. So as far as the town programs, we're recording this show on Friday, just full disclosure. The 10 district team is playing for a district title tonight down in Nashua. So we will know the outcome of that by the time the show airs tomorrow morning. They are playing against Goffstown. The 12 district team is in a similar situation, I should say. They're playing Goffstown tonight. However, if the 10s win, they win the district. If the 12s win, they get to come back and play again tomorrow. They are on the loser's bracket playing their way out. The 10s are in the catbird seat, as Red Barber would have said back in the day. They are controlling their own destiny. And the 11 district team, just by virtue of the torrential rains that we had earlier this week, the 11 district team was originally scheduled to start on Wednesday. They don't start playing until right after this airs tomorrow. They play at 12:30 down at LaJoy Field down in Nashua, or Lajoie Field, depending on is it Poutine or Poutsen? Depending on your pronunciation, and I guess how Mr. Lajoie, who they named the field after, chose to pronounce it. I'm not really sure. But anyway, wherever you slice it, that's where they're playing, and they had a good run in their pool play. So we wish all of the Bedford teams the best. And while we were out there in Nashua 2 days ago, you see somebody wearing a Levine 24 shirt. And no, it's not that it's a somebody's fangirling or standing all over the place. It's his brother, Kyle.
Okay.
So it's appropriate and acceptable. Kyle was down there watching, though. And we had a very good crowd down there the other night, and hopefully we'll have a good crowd here tonight as well. But Grant's still cruising right along in the Pioneer League.
Yeah. What is he, 361? Is that what you said?
Grant is hitting 361 right now. Five home runs, 25 driven in. According to this, Grant homered on, and we knew this already, Grant homered Wednesday. Took the collar, was 0 for 4 yesterday, Thursday, and is now at 361. But still an impressive run, on-base percentage 448. So he has done nothing that I guess we wouldn't have expected him to do right out of the gate. Actually, he's vastly exceeded any expectations I had for him.
Yeah, awesome start. And with the most recent homer giving him 5, that reminds me of today's trivia question.
Yes.
There was a historic home run hit.
Is this going to be a thing now?
I think it would be a fun thing. Historic home run hit in Major League Baseball on this date many years ago. Do you have a guess at what it was?
Dwayne Kuiper.
No.
Dwayne Kuiper. Notably, Dwayne Kuiper hit one home run in his entire career. So wait, how many years ago? I wasn't listening.
That's what I'll do. I'll give you the year. It was 1976.
1976. Okay.
July,
wow.
So July, you're like, 20th, 1976.
Okay, so that's like 2 weeks. Wow. Post bicentennial.
Yeah. The weird thing about it is that it's in the middle of the season. So it obviously can't be a most homers hit in the season.
No, it's more of a career milestone type thing.
True.
So 1976. I'm sitting here thinking about it.
Somebody who played from the 50s. Into the 70s.
Oh, okay, so now you're just giving it away. That's not fair.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, okay, I just also want to go on note and say that July 20th, 1969, also a big day in American history, landed on the moon 49 years ago today. You're giving it away because now I'm sitting there going, players who are older, who would have been finishing up their careers. I know Hank Aaron set the home run record in 1974. Against Al Downing. Al Downing would be a good guest on this show. But I know Hank Aaron set the record. I am only going to assume he played for the Brewers and then he came back. Did he finish up with the Braves or did he finish up with the Brewers?
I don't recall.
I'm going to assume that it was Hank Aaron. That it wasn't. I mean, that it seems like it would have been right around the time that he would have just been saying, "I'm out. See you later."
Very strong assumption.
Yeah.
Hank Aaron's final home run, number 755.
So Hank Aaron is now getting up there in years. How you have no computer in front of you, and I do, and I have fast Google fingers. Hank Aaron is now, he was born in 1934 in Mobile, Alabama. That makes him 84 years old. So when last I saw Hank Aaron on TV, he was showing that he was 84. We saw him, it was the 2005 season, because Jenny was...
That was the last time you saw him on TV?
No, we saw him in person.
Oh.
Got to ride down an elevator with him at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee, and just randomly. And so that would have been, 13 years ago-ish. And you looked at that guy at 71, and he honestly looked like he could have rolled out and still knocked a couple base hits and probably shagged some flies. He was... People talk about how you can tell what a professional athlete or a former professional athlete looks like because they carry themselves a certain way. And there is a degree of confidence that goes along with that. But there's also a lot of these guys tend to stay in good shape and present themselves very well. And he was no exception when it came to that. Like, you looked at Henry Aaron, he was as recognizable as could be, simply because he didn't look a whole lot different than he did when he was playing baseball in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. Well, the last time I saw him was on an ESPN broadcast earlier this season. He joined the booth in a Braves home game and chatted on air for a while and seemed sharp and excited that they were honoring him. And it was a game in which Ozzie Albies hit a home run.
Yep.
So it's kind of seeing some of the passing of the torch from one of the greatest all-time recognizable Braves to Albies.
So, and Hank Aaron, as we discussed with Bob Kendrick a few weeks back, was a former Negro Leagues player as well. He was an Indianapolis Clown, but no shortage of impressive records for Henry Aaron, 755 home runs being the most notable. And would you still consider that to be the home run record?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was within the rules of baseball.
Yep.
No cheating, not non-tainted. That's the best. He's the king.
He is the king, and always handled himself exactly. It just he was a great ambassador and still continues to be a great ambassador for the game. I remember when he was on Happy Days when I was probably 8 or 9 years old and convincing my parents to let me stay up late because I wanted to see Hank Aaron on Happy Days. You know, hey, it's the little things, right?
Right.
So, all right, we can segue from that. This is all, like, going nicely. We can segue from that into home runs.
Yeah, I mean, there was a contest on Monday.
Dude.
Called the Home Run Derby.
That was fun.
There was a lot of long balls that night.
That was fun. It's, you know, and you'll get it at some point. But you start to watch these guys who Bryce Harper is not by any stretch old. His dad probably isn't much older than I am. I mean, his dad's probably in his early 50s. And his dad, first of all, his dad's jacked.
He is.
Like, somebody said it on ESPN, he looked like Randy Macho Man Savage.
I'm gonna get into that. Here's what happened starting in the semis on Monday night. Schwarber, upper decks, semifinal walk-off shot. Two hands raised by mound. Hometown Harper hits final round heater with pops, 9 of last 10 swings. Tied up, bonus round, the center of attention. Bryce straight delivers. Championship belt tossed from two hands raised by mound. Red, white, and blue bat.
We enjoyed the bat flip. We enjoyed the bat.
That was cool. I mean, it had the American flag on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it seemed like a pretty natural moment to me. You know, he just put his both hands up with the bat across it, like it was a championship belt, and just sort of shot
two-handed bat flip. Yep. We were having the argument. It was me and the girls in the house. my wife was watching The Bachelorette, and but it was me and the girls, and we're having an argument over Bryce Harper's hair and whether he I have hair envy for Bryce Harper's hair. I think Bryce Harper has good hair. My kids are split on that, but the
highlighted by the bandana.
I thought it was all cool. His dad was his struggle to find it, and then all of a sudden found it for the last minute, and Bryce was just rocket. Which was just, it's pleasurable to see and just the joy. The funniest thing to me about Bryce Harper, and I don't know what it is, but every time I look at him when he talks, I feel like he's a Will Ferrell character.
Could be.
Like, it's he gets there and you expect that he's going to say something great. And what does he say to the nice job?
Yeah. Yeah, and he says he was saying something about his home run, something like, you know, I was trying to come out and put on a show for the fans, and I did that.
Yeah, it's just
a tiny bit awkward.
It's like this Jackie Moon kind of thing. I don't. Yeah.
Yeah, especially with the way that he looked.
Yeah.
That night.
Yeah.
With the bandana. Everything on his body was red, white, and blue. He had all kinds of different things.
I may have done that on the 4th of July. I may have been at the Little League field throwing BP wearing red. Well, they look like American flag shorts, but they're red, white, and blue. Wearing the MLB socks with a red, white, and blue glove. Wearing an MLB shirt that is red, white, and blue.
Did you hit?
And sporting the New Hampshire primaries hat that has Uncle Sam with the bat that is red, white, and blue. Like, it was, yeah.
Did you hit between 45 and 50 home runs?
No, I did not. Come on. Yeah. I could be standing on second base in Nats Park and I wouldn't hit between 45 and 50 home runs. You've seen me hit.
Yeah, he put on a
contact,
show.
Contact, not power.
He put on a show with a lot of shots over 440 feet.
Yeah. It's a pleasure to see it. I mean, and again, it goes back to we're sitting there watching it on TV and we say, you know, he hits one of the warning track and everybody goes, your warning track. you don't realize what it takes to do that. Like, again, some of these things that we grossly oversimplify because these guys are so good, kicking field goals, completing passes of long range, catching a ball that is thrown and just drops into your hands a millisecond before a safety comes helmet first into your jaw. I mean, these things that these guys and golf, I don't even want to start with golf.
We'll get to that.
These things these guys make look so simple that just aren't.
Well, the funny that reminds me of one of the craziest things I heard. I can't remember if it was during the Home Run Derby or in the All-Star game. Did you hear what they said about Freddie Freeman during his batting practice sessions over the last 3 years?
No.
He has not hit a single home run in 3 years of batting practice.
Why?
Well, obviously on purpose, he's just trying to hit line drives.
But
how could you not hit a mistake? Like you just,
right.
All right, I'm trying to pepper the left center gap. He's a left-handed hitter. So, okay, I'm going to try and, you know, stay back on the ball and just pepper the left center gap with doubles. I mean, you're going to have a mistake that just gets up a little bit higher and goes out because he's that strong and powerful. I mean, I think he has 20-plus home runs during the regular season this year already. So he's a home run hitter.
Yes.
I could not believe that.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
That's discipline. to make sure you don't just, I'm just going to jack one here.
Or just not to, like, home runs are, it's like candy.
Yeah.
Like, we used to go in when I was working in Kansas City, we'd take BP on the field and that was the goal. Like, I'm trying to hit balls out of this place. Like, can you please, all right, that left field wall is 315 feet away and it's 23 feet high. Can you please throw fastballs off my knee so that I can turn on one and jack it over the mini monster?
Exactly.
Because that's all I want to do. Because right. I know I'm not going to hit it 396 to center. But, like, that's the goal.
Yeah,
apparently not for Freddie Freeman.
Apparently not. So that was really fascinating to me. But it was one of the best home run derbies ever. A lot of great moments. You know, Bregman in the first round, he had a real big comeback. He was up to 15 homers, and his last swing, he hit it off the wall and left. So he was unable to advance.
Yep, he got the base.
And he's, you know, a small guy. But he put on a show. And then Schwarber, who was in the semis, I mean, he's one of the, you got to tip your cap to a guy who didn't actually win. He was great throughout, and it was just fun to watch his swing, which is really compact, and he would just stay on top of the ball and just hit these bullets into the upper deck and right.
Yeah.
I mean, just really entertaining.
Yeah, so watching those guys, they put on a show, and then the next night we got an all-star game that basically consisted of nothing except home runs.
Home runs and strikeouts.
It's everybody has turned into Adam Dunn.
That's right. The entire league
They're
is Adam Dunn.
They're all free through outcome.
They just have a slightly better batting average than Adam Dunn.
Yes, but all these guys are three true outcome guys. I mean, that's where it's gone. And ultimately, that's what happened in the All-Star game where Bregman and Springer both went yard in the 10th inning. And, you know, then just so many weird things were going on during that and this is, I guess, the world that we live in now, 2018. The moral of the story is never tweet unless you're tweeting haiku.
Exactly.
And inoffensive haiku at that. But
if we hadn't cleared that up a few weeks ago, back in April, when we were talking about the Major League, the NFL draft.
Oh, God. Josh Allen,
I mean,
yeah.
Everybody should have listened.
Yeah, exactly. Laramie Tunsil. But you look. I mean, that was interesting. So what we're referring to is Josh Hader, who's a relief pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers, who is having what I would describe as a video game stat year. He struck out
almost two per inning.
Yeah, it's like 89 in
40-something
innings. I mean, it's just insane the number of strikeouts this kid has. And was in the All-Star game and gave up a 3-run home run, which I don't remember who said it, but that turned out to be the second worst thing that happened to him that night.
Exactly.
Jeff Passan mentioned it at one point. He noticed it in the crowd. Somebody was wearing a Hader jersey, which it's a shirt that looks like a jersey. Scherzer.
Scherzer.
Yeah, apparently those exist too. But somebody was wearing one of those, and Passan saw a person turn it around, like turn it inside out. And then somebody else noticed that the family was given new jerseys, and very quickly come to find out that Hader, when he was 17, tweeted a bunch of things that were offensive, patently offensive. And somebody somewhere who had all kinds of axes to grind about Hader decided, hey, this guy's on the stage. We're going to release all this stuff.
And out they came. The night changed immediately for him. He said after the game, he got to his phone and had just blown up with texts.
It's almost like, and I'm not, in no way am I justifying anything that Hader did or tweeted 7 years ago. You can only imagine. I mean, I most of the work that I do is in the digital world. It's social media. It's emails. And I heard something, I don't remember, it was years ago. Oh, it was a social media marketing person who was a VP or at an agency or something along those lines who tweeted something out and then proceeded to get on an airplane, turn her phone off, and she had tweeted something offensive. The internet got a hold of that. And by the time she landed 6 hours later, she had lost her job. The internet hated her, and she didn't know any of it until she turned on her phone and it started going like a slot machine. Things like that blow my mind. I struggle, as a lot of people know, like, hey, we're all in this together. We're all on the same ride together, regardless skin color, sexual preference, whatever. We're all in the same boat. We all got to row in the same direction, help each other. And so thinking like that kind of blows my mind. Tweeting like that really blows my mind. And the sinking feeling and the sympathy that I have for is, you know, I've done it as marketing campaigns. You set something up and you hit send and the email goes and you go, oh my God, that was the wrong coupon, or it had an expiration date, or I just put an offer in the coupon that shouldn't have been there. How can I fix that? And okay, like that's a marketing challenge. That's a marketing challenge. But the sinking feeling you have pressing the send button, the next time you have to do that, you're like, oh boy, this is going to be tough. So that's where the empathy that I have comes from, is the kind of the helplessness of this is out there and now, okay, what do I have to do to fix it? To Josh Hader's credit, after the game, I will say he did a nice job. Just, he didn't shy away from the cameras. He didn't say no comment. He was up front. And that's all I ever want anybody to be. There's no, I was hacked or whatever. Yeah, I did it. It was wrong. It's not, doesn't reflect how I think. Hey, and his teammates backed him up.
Yeah,
it's Lorenzo Cain too.
Right.
Everybody knows how I feel about Lorenzo Cain.
That's the small amount of credit that he can get, is the way that he's handled it in the aftermath. And that included going up to Lorenzo Cain, his teammate in Milwaukee and his teammate on the All-Star team, and telling him face to face, it was wrong. That's not how I feel. And Lorenzo taking a moment, you know, listening to him and saying, okay, I believe him. I accept this. It obviously was not right, but he's been a great teammate to me. So he's, you know, he's lived the adult life side by side with him, and he's seen him as an adult, not as a 17-year-old kid.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's saying, all right, let's move forward. And he's forgiving him. And it's in large part because Hader just came out and apologized and said it was a terrible thing. It was a mistake. That's not how I feel anymore.
Yeah. And Jesus Aguilar did the same thing. Basically said, this is not the guy that I know in the clubhouse. And that gets back to one of my favorite things about sports. And it doesn't matter what color, religion, anything you are, it comes down to, can you help the team win? And that's all it's about, is can you help the team win? Are you a good teammate? That's it. And, you know, Hader may have been 17 years old, may have grown up with not a whole lot of, I don't know what his upbringing was, but for him now, he's played at various levels in the minor leagues and no doubt has had teammates of all race, creed, and color. It's now up, you know, he's matured. I hope for his sake he has. And I hope, you know, that his teammates have been understanding. And that's going back to the Brewers. That's a big thing that has been hit upon this year, is the change in this team is due to having a guy in the clubhouse like Lorenzo Cain, who really is a leader.
Yeah. And he's going to have to learn from the mistakes of his past, but also the mistakes on the mound that night. It was interesting how he was at the center of two of the biggest turning point plays in the game. He's facing Gene Segura late in the game. It's a 2-2 game. There's two men on base, and he induces Segura into a pop-up, and this is the pop-up that took Votto over to the National League dugout, and he dropped the ball right by the railing. Next pitch, Segura hits a 3-run homer off of Hader.
Yep.
So he's in line to get the loss. Everybody thought Segura would be the MVP, but then lo and behold, in the bottom of the ninth, when NL had reduced the deficit to 2, Scooter Gennett, last guy off the bench for the NL, hits that great home run on the inside. You talk about inside corner at the knees. He took an inside corner at the knees pitch and hit it into the bullpen, so he tied the game. And then we got the heroics that you talked about, with the back-to-back homers from the Astros in the top of the 10th. And the AL eventually held on to win it 8-6 with a new record of 10 home runs hit in the game.
Well, that was, if I'm not mistaken, and I chances are I am, because that's me. It is the first game in Major League Baseball history during the season, postseason, any game that is on record where each team has had 5 players hit a home run.
Yeah, 10 homers by 10 different guys.
Yeah.
The old record for homers in an All-Star game was only 6.
What have we done? And what has this game become?
And then this led to the stat that came up this week, which is that this year in Major League Baseball, there have been more strikeouts than hits. So you could talk about the 3 outcomes.
Yeah.
More strikeouts than hits, and it's going to be there's going to be the first time by the end of the season that has ever happened.
And yeah, assuming that it stays on pace, which no doubt it will.
Right.
Like the game's it's changed. And people love home runs, and they love the idea of a pitcher blowing a ball by a guy at 98 miles an hour, too. I mean, that's eye-popping.
And I believe the related stat was that this is on pace, again, to be the most home runs ever hit in a major league season. So it's record homers, record strikeouts.
Yes. And homers hit by smaller dudes.
Yeah, because they're
Altuve,
taking
Altuve, Bregman, yeah.
The new launch angle. They're literally swinging for the fences.
It's interesting. The other, I guess, story that goes along with it, you saw this, no doubt. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred comes out and says Mike Trout needs to do a better job of marketing himself.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, I've never heard anything like that from a commissioner making that direct of a commentary about a star player for something like marketing. I don't think I've heard of that in any sport. And it's a odd comment because Trout has an incredible reputation.
Yep.
And just wasn't expected. Just never would have thought I would have heard that. I haven't even heard Rob Manfred say anything controversial or negative about any individual player.
Yeah, it's it was a weird thing to say. Particularly, and I started seeing it, and probably because my social media feed contains a lot of baseball people, whether it's Twitter or Facebook. But what I started to see at that point was a lot of people defending him, but not defending him by saying, you know, hey, he does a great job of X, Y, and Z. Defending him by saying, here's a picture of Mike Trout with my kids. On the field, or here's a video of Mike Trout with a kid that he just dragged out of the stands who was wearing a Mike Trout jersey, and Trout spent 15 minutes with the kid and gave him a bat. Like, you know, he's a great guy for the game. I think Major League Baseball could do a better job of marketing itself.
Yeah.
And everything else will come from that rather than saying, you, one guy, you need to be on the pedestal for us.
Well, what I also noticed, I don't know if you saw this, but the Angels came out and released a statement the next day supporting Trout. Really, really nice statement that includes Mike Trout is an exceptional ambassador for the game. Combined with his talent, his solid character creates a perfect role model for young people everywhere. He continually chooses to participate in the community, visiting hospitals, schools, and countless other charities. And then it also talks about him as a person. What does he do when he's not playing? He says he spends quality time as a husband, son, brother, uncle, and friend. We applaud him for prioritizing his personal values over commercial self-promotion.
That's, you know, it's funny. The Angels have had the same communications director since I was in elementary school. A guy by the name of Tim Mead. That sounds like Tim Mead. Tim Mead's a community guy. And, that's what that organization has been built on. Look at the fact they haven't won a World Series since 2002. And Mike Socha is the longest tenured manager in baseball. Would Arte Moreno love to be winning the World Series every year? You bet. But is he also, he really genuinely enjoys being a Major League Baseball owner. And so, you know, they win, they're competitive, they're always in that sort of second tier, and eventually they're going to break back through again. But a lot of Southern Californians also remember the days in the 70s and 80s when the Angels were like the Clippers, you know.
And they've got this guy, and I just love how they came to his defense.
Yeah.
Where they said, by the way, he is visiting countless charities, so he's doing all these things, and he's not even promoting that. He's not being self-promoting about all the great things he's doing in the community, but he is doing them.
He's doing it on a micro level. And if he was on soda commercials and shilling fast food, yeah, sure, maybe he'd have more money. And yeah, sure, he'd be more visible. But does that make any kid really put up a poster in their room or say, this is who I want to be, or go out and buy a jersey? I don't think so. It's the one-to-one where somebody has a real genuine experience with a player that makes them love the game. Or somebody telling them about that.
Or you just watch him play one game.
Yeah.
And you see him play hard. You see him. He's won the MVP in the All-Star game twice. And he hit a home run in this All-Star game. He had a chance to win another one if, you know, the bevy of home runs hadn't come late in the game. You know, and like we talked about a few weeks ago, a lot of baseball writers consider him the best player today, if not the best player ever.
Yeah.
So there's so much to like about him, and hard to really find a way to complain about him.
Yeah, MLB, do a better job of promoting him. Try that.
Exactly.
Maybe. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break because we talked about baseball for the better part of half an hour, and there are other sports, although it's summer, so really it's baseball. So take a quick break. Come right back. You are listening to Fox on Sports. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. And this is the time of the show where we're talking about other non-baseball sports.
We're done talking about baseball. We're going to the rest.
Yeah, going to the rest of the sports. It's also a weird time of year because we're not really talking about any high school things, although it probably would behoove us to get Corey Parker in here at some point. I'm now like self-conscious of talking. I love my dentist. And I made a mistake of, I have a client that's a candy store. They had fresh caramel that had just come out of the line. I grabbed some, forgot that I had a crown, yanked the crown out, snapped the post, epic fail. So now I'm just sitting here feeling the crown on the right side of my mouth, like, fall. So if you hear me slur my words, that's why.
Note to self, don't eat fresh caramel.
Oh, they're so good, though. Yeah. I'm not allowed to eat it anymore, but yeah. Just add it to the list. Anyway, so on that note, really or not, golf, it's British Open time.
And for some, I guess it is sort of like pulling teeth.
Yeah, nice. That's a good segue.
If you catch the wrong side of the humps and bumps over in Scotland, or you get stuck up against the face of a 6-foot-high bunker, it can be rough. I mean, the number one player in the world, Dustin Johnson, was cruising along, but he hit one out of bounds on a par 5, managed to make par. So he basically eagled it, but he'd hit one out of bounds.
Yep.
Then he came to the 18th hole in his first round and hit one out of bounds left, which you just looked at some videos. Some crazy things have happened on the left side of the green at 18 already.
Yes.
In this Open. But he went out of bounds, made an other score, and he's going to miss the cut at plus 6. Number 2 in the world, Justin Thomas, is going to miss the cut probably at plus 4. So even though those guys are hitting it 400 yards in some cases, because there hasn't been any rain over there and the fairways are drier and harder and firmer and faster than they've ever been by all accounts, those big hitters are going to be watching from home.
Right. It's one of those things. With links courses, you never quite know exactly what is going to happen, not to mention they do not manicure the courses the same way that we manicure most courses here.
They don't even water the fairways.
Right.
That's why they're so fast.
I mean, the Target Golf that we see here, you know, where it's, okay, I'm center of fairway, center of green. Oh, I'm not. Maybe you are. But
occasionally.
The Target Golf that we see here versus the golf that is played, golf without the L, as Judge Smale said in Caddyshack, that is an entirely different thing and requires a skill set. I can't imagine how long it would take me to go and how many balls I would go through if I tried to play 18 there.
Well, it's a golf challenge at a whole new level because the conditions impact the play so much. Just from day one to day two, we've seen that, where in the first round, those drives, some of them were rolling out 90 to 100 yards. Same thing with 3-irons, going 240, 250 yards easily. But now it's raining in day two. So all of a sudden, you know, instead of trying to land it 30 yards short of the green, knowing it's going to roll up, maybe you have to actually land it 10 yards short of the green.
Right.
So it's the caddies come into play like in no other tournament.
Absolutely. And the practice rounds come into play. If you haven't been paying attention, you're going to just get clobbered.
Right, right. But, you know, we talked about a couple of guys that missed the cut, a couple of guys who are going to make the cut. Looking like we're going to get Tiger and Phil over the weekend, which is fun. They're both at even par as we record this on Friday morning. Tiger was 2 under in the first round and easily could be under par. He missed a short birdie on 18 today, so he's in it even. Phil is doing his normal Phil thing. It's kind of funny. He had made a couple birdies this morning, then he yanked a drive about 50 yards right. Somehow made a double without going out of bounds. Then he was wearing his two black gloves. So then he took off the gloves, and now he's got it back to even par. So going to be great to see those guys contend. Kisner is running away with it. He's 8 under right now. But if he can come back a little bit and have Tiger and Phil within 6 shots, you know, maybe if one of them gets hot, they can contend.
And yeah, you never quite know because you're one bad hole away from completely destroying your entire round, John Vandeveld.
Yes, and this was the course, Carnoustie.
Yeah, yes.
We've seen some interesting shots around that Barry Byrne as well on that highlight reel.
Yep.
Sergio played out of it and was able to hit it from the water and clear the face in front. He's going to miss the cut. And then Ian Poulter hit one that hopped over the burn and actually rolled through and up over the lip of a bunker on 18, somehow didn't go out of bounds. So that happened at the end of day one. I thought that was going to propel him, but he actually shot 10 over today, and he's going to miss the cut. One of the fun things for me with the Open is the fact that you've got the biggest field in a major with all these guys from all over the world in different backgrounds. And one of the ones, I mean, you hear these names you've never heard before.
Right.
They qualify from somewhere that you don't know where they're coming from. One of the guy that just jumped out at me, this guy's, he's 4 under. He's on the first page of the leaderboard, Erik van Rooyen,
yep,
who is South African, and somehow he decided to go play college golf at the University of Minnesota.
I know that if I was from a beautiful country like South Africa, I would want to go to Minnesota.
Just to...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just to experience the different climate, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the extent of it.
Yeah, I don't know the backstory of why he went there, but that one's fascinating to me.
Yeah, so where's he at now?
He's at 4 under.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Okay.
He shot 4 under in the first round, even in the second, so he's tied for sixth.
So if we're looking at the tournament now, you have Kisner, Johnson, Tony Finau. You would figure, though, it's anybody within 4 or 5 strokes at this point would still have a chance.
Yeah, Ricky Fowler is making a charge. He's 3 under through 6 holes, so he's in the top 10. Maybe it'll be his first major. That would be fantastic.
And what is with Tommy Fleetwood having these just stellar rounds? He already shot a 6 under today. So
he has the course record at Carnoustie. He shot it last fall. He shot a 63.
Yep.
And I saw some footage of it. You know, it was in October, and he had a winter hat on, just cruising around with 8 birdies, no bogeys. You know, just your normal 63 in October.
You know, that's easy. Hey, whatever.
In competition.
Again, it goes back to the same thing we were just talking about. These guys make this look way easier than it is.
Well, that reminds me. I want to mention that if you can't get to Scotland by tomorrow, if you're listening to this Saturday morning.
I was planning on it, but I have somewhere else to be.
Right. I mean, it would be a fun little weekend getaway. Yeah. But if you can't do that, you can go to the New Hampshire Open next Monday through Wednesday at Goffstown, Stonebridge. And that's a great way to get up and close to some excellent golfers. I mean, it's a mixture of pros and amateurs. The first place prize is actually $10,000.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And, you know, I've had a chance to play with a couple of the guys who are going to be in it, and it's really fun to watch them play because they can really stripe it.
Yeah.
They make the game look easy, and you've never heard of them because they're not professionals right now, but there's a real... There's not that much difference between these guys in these local tournaments that you go watch. Like, I played with one of them, his 20-year-old, Brendan Gillis, I played 18 holes with him. He made 6 birdies.
What did he shoot?
Well, he shot around even par. He had a couple bad holes, but he was just, first of all, he never took a single practice swing. So
okay.
He's practiced so much that he just, you know, he gets the yardage, visualizes the shot, and then he just hits it. And every single shot was the perfect distance. Really made the game look easy. It was really fun to watch. I also got a chance to play with this current amateur named Tom Kirkman, who had played on some mini tour in England. And he also had a chance to, I just got paired up with him on the course. And he came out to Stonebridge to get a feel for the layout. He'd never played the course before, and the tournament is next Monday, so he needs to know what he's playing. And it's one of those courses that you really need to have some knowledge about the holes. And he wasn't even playing in golf shoes, but he was hitting every drive straight. Yep. And his putts were just looked so effortless, always rolling true. It's just really fun to see golfers up close who've mastered the game.
And you have an appreciation, first of all, for how much it takes for them to get there, because it's not with a lack of work. But then in addition to that, what the next level of people look like and just how amazing and how much time it requires for them to get to that point. And the byproducts of that, we talked about the Tiger Woods Nike commercial where he's hitting the ball on his, I don't remember what club it was, where he's basically just like...
One of his irons.
Yeah, like he's using a flyback, like one of the paddles with the rubber ball attached to it. He's doing it with one of his irons and then flips it up high enough and stripes it about 150 yards out. And that, it's not like one day he set out and said, I'm just going to start bouncing the ball on my club. Just when you're around it enough, you just pick up these weird tricks.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you play golf as at that level and you're playing 6 or 7 days a week, you're spending hours on the range every day. I mean, you got to have a little fun occasionally.
Yeah, of course you're going to play around and do that sort of stuff.
So,
and that's just, there are a lot of things that some professional amateur athletes, whatever, just be by virtue of the amount of time that they spend out there. There are little side benefits that go along with it where some of these guys, I'll refer to them as witches. Like, they can do things that the rest of us just can't do because they are just immersed in it and they have that level of coordination and they know, okay, if I see it in my head, my body can execute it.
Well, the ultimate short game witch that we've already mentioned along with Tiger is Phil. And there's a video going on this week of his flop shot. Did you see that?
I've seen one years ago of him hitting one back over his head. Was that back again?
No, this one was, he had somebody stand in front of him, the distance between you and me. I think it was 2 yards.
Yeah.
And he stood up tall. It looked like he was 5'10 or so. And Phil got in front of him with his wedge, took a full swing, and hit a flop shot over the guy's head from 2 yards away. Took a full swing directly at him.
Yeah.
And the guy just stood there and had the faith that Phil would pull it off, and sure enough, he did.
Yep. It's like shooting an apple off somebody's head. That's it. So good luck to the golfers in the New Hampshire Open. You said it starts Wednesday. How many days
Monday,
does it go?
Monday through Wednesday.
Monday through Wednesday.
Yep.
So should be. Are you going to go?
I'm going to try and check it out probably on Monday. Yeah.
So some other random things in the world of sports. There is a guy who... is in Denver, who's a baseball card collector, who bought a rare Mickey Mantle card, who is now displaying it for, what they say, 48 hours?
Right, just a small window of opportunity to go take a look.
I don't know how many people are going to go. Would you go?
No. Probably not just for that.
No.
I don't recall what the rest of the event was.
Yeah, no.
But the man you speak of, Marshall Fogle, bought the card back in 96 for
$120,000. No.
He thinks it's worth 100 times that because he has now insured it for $12 million.
I want to know who took that policy. Like, that's a lot of money to, I don't know. I mean, I'm looking at, and you sent the article along. So the story about this card is that they were scarce because they took a barge of them to the Hudson River and sunk them.
Right. This is in 1952.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the retailers hadn't sold as many cards as they planned on it. And they were getting ready for the batch of 1953 cards. So they returned them. And that's what happened to those cards. They sunk them to the bottom of the Harlem River. So somewhere down there, there are cards that are potentially worth millions of dollars.
And squishy. The story that I heard, and I want to say I heard it from my dad, but you know, at this point that was ages ago. The story that I heard was that there were so many of them, the Mickey Mantle cards in 1952, and everybody back then flipped cards. You know, you'd put them in the spokes of your bike, they'd play games with them, they'd flip them, but everybody had so many Mickey Mantles you couldn't give them away, and nobody wanted them, and so it was. It's like the Yogi Berra, that restaurant's so busy, nobody goes there anymore.
Right.
Same basic concept of, you know, hey, there are all these cards. Everybody chucked them because it felt like there were too many of them. And then you wind up here where, what is it, 60-something years later, now people are talking about this like it's worth $12 million.
It's all about supply and demand.
Yeah, it's economics. I just don't know how many people are going to go and go to a museum in Denver in summer to check out a baseball card when I can Google 1952 Mickey Mantle tops and go, I've seen it.
It does have striking colors, though. And the reason why he doesn't display it more is to preserve the colors in it.
Right.
So it's just kind of an interesting little sector of the sports world.
I don't know. It's also a weird picture, though, because Mickey Mantle looks angry in the card. He has 5 o'clock shadow.
The bat looks very yellow.
The bat is yellow.
It?
Yeah, it's weird. It's, I don't know. It's scarcity. I mean, it's supply and demand.
There are only three that have been rated gem mint PSA 10. And of the three that are A ratings, his is the only one that's A+.
There you go.
There's the story.
So, hey, if you're in Denver and really are bored, you go can check out a baseball card that some dude thinks is worth $12 million.
There are basketball cards as well, never quite as famous as baseball cards, but
Talk about it. I'm so mad.
Some of the guys on the basketball cards will have new colors next year because there have been some trades and various transactions in the NBA.
I was mad about the basketball court. You're too young to remember this. It was Phil Ford, Magic, and Larry Bird in the 1979-80 tops, and they put, so tops at that point in time, did you know about this?
No.
Okay, so tops at that point in time put three guys on each card, but perfed the cards. So it was a regular baseball-sized card, but one-third of it was Magic, one-third of it was Larry Bird, one-third of it was Phil Ford. Well, what do you do when you're 5 or 6 years old and you get a basketball card that has three guys in it?
You cut it into thirds?
You perforate it and you cut them into thirds because they're meant to be individual cards. Well, you know, fast forward the better part of 40 years later and you go, wow, those cards are really worth a lot now.
If you kept them together in one piece.
Or if you hadn't traded away your Wayne Gretzky cards from the same year, but whatever. Yeah, it is what it is.
Right.
All right, continue.
So the guys
segue over.
The guys who've most recently changed their colors include Kawhi Leonard. The saga in San Antonio has come to an end. He has been banished north of the border all the way to Toronto. San Antonio.
Toronto is a nice place.
Yeah. Well, it apparently wasn't Kawhi's first choice. Kawhi's first choice has been L.A., specifically the Lakers. Sounded like he was open to being traded to the Clippers.
Yep.
But the Spurs said, well, that's all well and good, but we've decided that if we're going to move you, we're going to send you to the Eastern Conference. We are going to send you north of the border to an entirely different country. You wanted to be traded. Here you go. You're now a Toronto Raptor.
By the way, that 1980-81 card was Larry Bird, Julius Erving, and Magic Johnson. Dr. J was the middle one. I don't know why I thought it would have been Phil Ford, but neither here nor there. What that's really a testament to me about is don't run afoul of Pop, because if you run afoul of Pop, he's going to literally exile you to another country.
Exactly.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I think it says a lot about the situation there in San Antonio and how everybody feels about each other. He did, to Pop's credit, he came out and said all the right things after the trade. He praised Kawhi for his hard work, his development, how he was. He actually said that he was great as a teammate, wished him the best. You know, talked about how he has relationships with former players and he, you know, values staying in touch with them. And it sounded like he hoped the same would be true with Kawhi. So I'll give him credit for that. But very, very interesting story now for over a year that has turned out with Kawhi going to Toronto. And the thing about it for the Spurs is I do actually think they got quite a solid return.
Oh, yeah.
Because they DeMar DeRozan, who has 3 years left on his contract, guy who can score 25 a night if you want him to.
Mm-hmm.
They also have next year's Toronto first-round draft pick as long as it's not 1 through 20. So assuming Toronto makes the playoffs, advances past the first round, which they should do, they get a, let's say their first round pick next year is 22 or 23. It's going to go to the Spurs. And the Spurs are probably the only team in the NBA who, if you gave them the option of, let's say, a pick between 3 and 5 or three picks between 23 and 25, they might actually go for three picks between 23 and 25 because
their guys are there.
All they want to do is draft the international players. And that's where they've gotten Manu and Tony Parker. Yes, they got David Robinson and Tim Duncan at the top, but they do such a great job drafting at that juncture in the draft that the first round pick from Toronto is actually a potentially big piece. So the fact that they get DeRozan for 3 years under contract, Kawhi only has 1 year left going to Toronto, I think the Spurs did a great job of maximizing the return. The other really interesting thing about how this all played out was, I think it's this upcoming week when USA Basketball is supposed to get together in Vegas and train for the first time with Greg Popovich as the now new USA Basketball coach. And of course, Kawhi is on that team. Can you imagine how that would have played out if on those first couple practices, Kawhi does show up, Popovich is the head coach, and he's addressing the team, and you talk about an elephant in the room.
Yeah.
You know, because Kawhi is not, he's not even working out for the Spurs right now. He hasn't been as a Spur going to workouts. And so the Spurs haven't seen him play. So this would have been the first time that anyone from the Spurs would have seen him play in the USA Basketball setting. And, you know, Popovich is trying to gel the team together and bring everybody together and get them fired up for international competition. And, you know, his star player in San Antonio, everybody knows, wants out. So I think that played a big role in the Spurs saying, let's take care of this now, because that would just be an untenable dynamic for Popovich and USA Basketball.
Right. And, you know, the kind of collateral damage in this whole thing is DeMar DeRozan, who, great player, where the Raptors are going to get where they needed to go, hard telling.
Probably not.
He loved being in Toronto. And that was his place to be. He was happy with the team, happy with the situation. They loved him. But in order to get the franchise to the next level, they did have to make a change. Is Kawhi Leonard going to be the guy that's going to get him there? The East is looking better by the day. So maybe he will, maybe he won't. I don't know. But and it'll be interesting also to see if DeMar DeRozan comes around and says, I'm cool to play for Pop. If anybody, the one or two people who've listened to a good amount of these shows know that I am a big fan of Greg Popovich, and his methods and the fact that he wins, and tends to, he tends to deflect a lot from his players. He tends to wear a lot for those guys. And so I think ultimately once DeRozan gets over the fact that he's hurt, it's going to be a really good opportunity.
Yeah, and you know, he'll fit right in with the Spurs if he can kind of play through injury, you know, and battle through anything that comes his way. You know, you know a thing or two about that as, you know, longtime athlete.
Yeah, as the crown actually falls out of my mouth. Well, at least I'm not slurring anymore.
Just powering through the segment. This is impressive.
It's really funny. I'm like, oh, hey, there you go. Here's part of a tooth.
It looks like a large part of a tooth.
Yeah, well, that's what happens. You get a root canal and the thing just goes, see ya. So I'm going to have to figure something out as it pertains to that. Whoops. So what else? You had a number of other things on your list, but we have like one more minute that we can actually talk about it.
Oh, that's it? Well,
yeah. Marcus, time is fun when you're having flies.
Well, yeah, so the odds are against the Raptors because Kawhi is going to give them a new dynamic, but the Celtics just re-signed.
Celtics are stacked.
Restricted free agent Marcus Smart to a four-year deal for $52 million. Major signing for them, glue guy, and
he's another one. He wants to be here, and he seemingly loves being a part of the team, the town, the system, everything. So hey, why not? I will take the guy that I know, who I know. I'm pretty sure what he's going to produce year in and year out, and he knows what he's going to. What's going to go on up here versus, okay, let's try to upgrade it a little bit, and the guy just doesn't fit.
Yeah, and the funny
thing
is,
he knows he fits.
That might be part of the reason why a year from now, if they don't re-sign Kyrie Irving, it's in part because of how much they've committed to Marcus Smart, and they don't want to have a max player in Kyrie with the luxury tax. And well, we also know that maybe Kyrie wants to leave, but the Celtics are going all in on this season, and they're saying, we're not trading anybody. We're re-signing Smart. We're keeping Kyrie. Get everybody healthy, and they are the favorite to go to the final. So I don't think Toronto's going to be enough to knock them off. So big deal for the Celtics with that re-signing.
So, yeah. So what we really got through with all this sort of stuff is baseball, a whole mess of it, some golf, some baseball memorabilia, and a little bit of NBA because we can't get through it without that.
That's
so,
right.
Wanted to thank everybody here for all of their hard work week in and week out. Harry Kozlowski, Chris Gentry, Bill Jennings, and Colleen Richardson. And thank my co-host, Andrew Hansen, for all of his hard work. He's like the show producer. He's the one who comes up with the topics. I just show up. So, you know, I try. And thank you to everybody for listening. I hope you have a wonderful sports week. We will catch you next week, assuming that I can talk.